Welcome to Vancouver Opera Offstage. I'm your host, Les Dalla, Chorus Director and Associate Conductor at Vancouver Opera. Join me for this podcast as we connect with opera experts, artists, staff, and others to explore the world of opera on and off the stage. We are honored to share our stories on the unceded homelands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. Good afternoon and welcome to the podcast. It is my pleasure to have Mike Southworth, the founder of Collide Entertainment, who has been working with Vancouver Opera throughout the season on all of the digital productions and on the Wagner for Valentine's project as cameraman, editor, producer, many, many things. I'm so happy that Mike, in his incredibly busy schedule, was able to join us. So welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Les. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited about this because your world, although obviously we've worked together this year, but your world is a very big, mysterious world to me, and I'm sure to a lot of our listeners. So I look forward to getting a little bit behind the scenes, or I think behind the lens is what we're calling this episode, which I think is appropriate. I have to admit, a year ago, I didn't know you. I didn't know your work. And now that I'm getting to know your work and seeing, you know, on your website, I just think, how is this even possible that I had not been aware of the amazing things that you do? I love the quote on your website on Collide Entertainment, and I'm quoting this exactly. Some might say I am a jack of all trades, but I prefer Swiss Army knife. And I love that quote. And indeed, based on all the skills that you have and roles that you perform, I would agree. How did you get mixed up in all of this in the first place?
I'll try and keep the story fairly short because it's, you know, I'm 41 now, so I've gotten to do a lot of cool things over the last 22, 23 years or whatever. But yeah, I've definitely always had my feet in many pools at the same time. I went to music school at Selkirk College in Nelson, which is kind of, it was built as like a feeder school for Berklee College of Music out of Boston. And I really wanted to go to Berklee. I had a teacher in high school who was a Berklee grad, and he was just one of those teachers that inspired so many students. His name's Brian Pratt Johnson, PJ, everybody calls him. And there was a chunk of time where there was so many incredible musicians coming out of Salmon Arm, and it's mostly to do with him. He just was such an inspiring teacher and could have easily been a university prof, and he ended up in this high school music program and really did some amazing things. So I wanted to go to Berklee, but I found out about this school in Nelson, which felt like a little bit of an easier move from a small town to another small town. And the tuition, I think, was like $800 a semester instead of 18,000 US or whatever, right?
Wow.
And so I was like, okay, that sounds good. And it was set up by all ex-Berklee teachers that were kind of moving to a small town to have families, and they use the Berklee curriculum, you use all the Berklee workbooks, et cetera. And then you technically can go out of your second year at Selkirk and into your third year at Berklee. So it's a pretty good deal as a Canadian to be able to do that. And that was definitely my intent. But in the jack of all trades thing, I ended up doing drums and engineering. And then I went back and did another major of voice and performance. So even then, I was kind of not sticking to one thing. And I know that some of my teachers were like, oh, you should just focus on one thing, you know, don't do so many different things. But I've always just enjoyed doing a variety of things. So I started recording and I moved to Vancouver. I joined the Musicians Union and did a whole bunch of, you know, corporate jazz gigs and those types of things, all of the hotels and playing the lawyer parties and things like that. And then I started a recording studio on the North Shore and slowly transitioned more into, once I got enough clients, into doing recording gigs. And I did pretty much solely recording studio engineering for a good 10, 12 years or something like that. And then started, during that time, I was playing in bands, and my wife, Hillary Grist, is a singer-songwriter. And I just started getting into doing videos for those bands that I was in and for my wife. And then, of course, my other studio clients would see the videos and go, oh, you should do one for me. Or, you know, when you're mixing or working on a project, you'll hear the same song over and over again for weeks. And so it's a great way to brainstorm about, hey, I think I've thought of a cool idea for a music video for this, you know. And so I just sort of started doing more and more music videos, and that just weirdly kind of took over. You know, it was like 25% of my work, and then 50% of my work, and then 75% of my work. And pretty soon I was doing way more music videos than I was doing recordings. And it kind of came at a good time because I felt like I'd been sitting in a studio. It's a great studio, but, you know, sitting in a room that's soundproofed and has no windows for 12, 13 years.
Wow.
And, you know, studio sessions are, I was working 6 or 7 days a week and usually 12, 14 hour days. And it just felt really exciting to get out of the studio and to do things in sound stages and weird warehouses and, you know, the penthouse downtown, or, you know, all sorts of interesting locations and with different people every day and stuff like that. And so, yeah, so I started doing that. And then a couple of the projects that I was working on that I was playing in started kind of taking off. And so I ended up doing a couple of years of pretty extensive touring, and got to tour Canada many, many times, and the States and Asia, did Korea 4 times and Japan and whatnot. And by the time I got back from that, I still had my studio, but I'd sort of rented out spaces and hired other people, and the place was kind of just working on its own. So when I got back from all of that touring, I just moved on into almost full-time video stuff and doing music videos. And then the people that I was working with on music videos originally were all kind of up and coming and people fresh out of film school and whatnot. So it was such a great way of learning. It was like free film school, free accepted. I paid for it with my own labor and not making very much money off of all these music videos. So I learned so much from these people. And then as they grew and got better, they started getting commercial and corporate gigs, and I kind of moved into that with them as well. So I started doing commercials and lots of TV commercials, lots of corporate stuff for, you know, TELUS and companies like that. And then all along, I was still doing a handful of a month of these live performance capture type things. I was doing a lot of stuff with Music on Main because they've been ahead of the game on this idea of really artistic performance capture and treating it as something of an elevated level, not just a camera at the back of the audience.
Right.
And I did some stuff with Bob Baker, who had just retired from Canadian Music Centre, and he was getting into that. So we toured a bit with National Youth Orchestra and whatnot. You know, it was one or two of these a month, maybe, and all the other corporate and whatnot was taking up the rest of my time. And then the pandemic happened, and it was this big, like, oh my God, I went from having my calendar being very, very full to absolutely nothing, which I think you probably experienced as well. And that's definitely, as a freelancer, that's a scary thing to have happen to you.
It is a scary thing. Yeah.
And Bob was actually one of the first people who saw these companies were going to need to figure out a way to put on their fall and winter seasons. Him and Dave Humphrey from The Chan.
Oh, yeah.
The two of them both were really championing this idea. So I helped The Chan build some live streaming and concert capture capabilities and helped them kind of figure out a way to do that. And then the first one we did was EMV in end of July. I was just looking yesterday and I've done 150 shows since then.
Since July, not even a year ago.
Since July 20th. And of course, 4 or 5 of those have been Vancouver Opera.
I guess when your calendar, everything just ground to a halt, it actually didn't take that long for everything to pick up, because that sounds like you're averaging a different show virtually every other day at this rate.
Yeah.
And I guess what you said about Music on Main, that is true. Like, they have been one of the pioneers in so many ways in the city. So everybody else coming on board is obviously, Vancouver Opera hadn't done anything like this before. And I guess EMV probably hadn't. Is this something you find in general with the classical music world, that it still is, I'm not going to say stuck, but it's very married to a certain way of presenting, right?
Yeah. And I think traditionally there was an idea that people didn't want to cannibalize their ticket buying audiences. They were worried that, you know, like, I filmed some EMV shows pre-pandemic. And I remember that even just camera positions, there was a lot of like, we shouldn't put a camera there because it might get in the way of one patron, you know. And I was saying, well, it's going to look so much better right here. Oh, I don't know. We don't want to like lose that seat. Right. And I think, you know, EMV, I know that they did some surveys with their audience and I think they've had a really incredible year of creating these amazing shows. I think we've done 18 or 20 EMV shows now. And, you know, I'm really proud of how they look. We've got Bill Richardson doing interviews, and he does such a thorough job. They're actually really interesting interviews. And a lot of people have said that they really appreciate being able to see the close-up details, these beautiful instruments up close, and these performers and this variety of angles as opposed to just your one spot in the theater.
Yeah, for sure.
Hopefully when audiences come back, I hope that maybe we can do a combination and still do some of these really beautifully created videos, you know, similar to what Music on Main had done beforehand.
From the many conversations I've been a part of this year, that seems to be the consensus with everyone that I've spoken with. Once live performance is back, of course, everybody's thrilled for that opportunity. But this is a whole world that has opened up. And again, what's so incredible about it is that somebody from another continent can tune in and watch this. And you just can't do that with a live performance, unless you're live streaming. So yeah, it has opened doors. Now, the various things that you do, and I'm just taking this off your website, you are an editor, a director, a sound recordist, a sound designer, composer, mixer, producer, and camera person. That is a lot of hats. So give me an idea for the EMV show. You would have acted in at least three or four of those capacities. Am I right?
I would have been directing it, running camera, and I would have been editing and doing sound for the interviews. Don Harder did the sound for all of the music performances. And I, you know, even my 15 years of audio engineering experience is nothing compared to Don's 35 years of CBC experience and two, I believe, Grammy Awards.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he has two Grammys. So it's amazing getting to work with somebody like him. And there's been a lot of great audio engineers that we've had on these. And that's something definitely in the, for lack of a better term, classical world that is really amazing, is how much care and attention the engineers and how much value the performers put on that audio capture. You know, it really is an art form unto itself. There's so much thought about how the microphones are placed and where the performers are on the stage. And it's just incredible the sound that they can get. The sound that Will Howie was able to get for Carmen, you know, with a lot of constraints, dealing with weird spacing and, you know, not a lot of setup time and having to hang mics to keep them out of the way. It was just gorgeous what he was able to do.
Yeah, agreed. And actually, since you mentioned that, I'd love to give a shout out. I know we had Grant Rowledge also as an engineer this year.
Yep.
Don Harder, of course, producers Denise Ball and George Laverock. Mm-hmm. Have I missed anybody?
James Perella.
Oh, yes.
Getting the setup at the Chan. He took that space from being, you know, traditionally a live performance venue to being a recording studio. He's really done some amazing things in there.
I got to do a recital of the UBC Noon Hour series with Christina Sobo, mezzo-soprano in town. I was just appointed to the faculty there. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was a little daunting and strange to be performing at the Chan with absolutely nobody in the house. I know we were both a little weirded out.
Yeah.
But having watched the video, I was so impressed with the sound and the picture capture. It was really, really beautiful and quite sad on the one hand that you think that that building has been relatively empty, at least as far as audience is concerned. But boy, there has been so much activity in there that I think people aren't as aware of if they're used to going to the space to take in a performance. But it is quite amazing. And of course, the Carmen, which by the time this comes out, it will have been released. We got to do with the Orpheum, which is a space that the opera doesn't perform in very often, occasionally for concert performance. But the fact that they've been doing things, the VSO, all season as well.
Yeah.
Kudos to all of the organizations that have been able to pivot and do things, because obviously there is no alternative this year. Live performances people were used to doing, that's simply not possible right now still. So,
yeah.
The year gets longer. I know that at the beginning, there were some, you know, who are like, well, maybe by September we'll be back. And it's like, okay, well, a year later, and it's still wondering when things might return to the live end. But in the meantime, amazing to be able to do these projects.
Yeah, and I think that you were saying the Chan, you know, I think this is probably one of their busiest years ever. There are days where just last week, we did one day where we did three shows in a day.
No kidding.
We had a Chinese music ensemble, and then we had a string ensemble, and then a live stream Q&A with Marina and Denise.
Okay.
And then two remote guests. And yeah, it was three things in there in one day. So,
wow.
And again, Dave really did a great job of right away, before people had even really understood what was happening. Okay, how are we going to make this work for the future? And how do we keep the staff that we have working? And how do we maybe even use this to our advantage? And they really did. They came out. I think the thing that we did with EMV was, as far as I know, the first live performance events of its kind in BC post-pandemic. People were still washing their groceries at that point, you know?
That's right. Yeah. And buying tons of toilet paper and hand sanitizer. Yeah.
Yeah. It was all so new still at that point. And even the commercial world, all of the commercials that I was working on, there was nothing happening that early. So it was pretty wild. It was easy for me to find crew in July.
Wow.
Everybody I called was like, yes, I'll do it. I didn't tell you when. I'll do it. I'm free.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Basically, you had set out to be a musician, a performer, I imagine, composer. You were talking about, you know, like Selkirk and Berkeley and potentially doing lots of recording projects and stuff. But I'm very curious. I didn't know that you were a composer, and I would love to hear a little bit about that. Not specifically for film projects, but for concert works or that sort of thing.
Yeah, I would say that I'm a composer, but not in the sense of somebody who did their composition degree. I've composed or helped people compose a lot of pop and rock and R&B and things like that. And I've done some jazz composition. And then in the commercial world, I've gotten to do a lot of faux classical composition. I wouldn't call myself a composer in the realm of what your audience would expect a composer to be, you know?
There are many, many realms out there. And I mean, let's face it, in the world of pop music and everything else, I mean, what people wouldn't give to write a great tune, you know?
Yeah.
And have it be successful. You mentioned you grew up in Salmon Arm.
Yeah.
And when you were a kid, I mean, did you play a number of instruments? You mentioned the music teacher, that was very pivotal. But in terms of, were you in a band? What was your sort of early exposure to music?
Yeah, I mean, my mom is and was a music teacher. And, you know, we always had instruments around. So we had pianos and guitars and basses. And even probably by 14 or 15, I played a lot of different instruments. And my mom would bring home a four-track cassette tape, four-track recorder from her school over the summer. And I used to record multi-track stuff on that myself. And then we had an old Ensoniq keyboard and I would do MIDI recordings and whatnot on that. So did a lot of music and was in various bands and really into music in high school. I mean, I took every choir and band and music composition course that I could. And the great thing again about that instructor that we had was that in, say, for example, the grade 12 music composition course, he was just using the Berkeley books. So when I got to Selkirk, I'd already done ear training 1 and 2. I'd already worked on all this stuff. So it was pretty amazing. Not very many people get that experience in high school. And I also did a lot of musical theater in high school. So that's definitely been one of those things that you never know what weird thing you'll do that will end up being useful. How a theatrical performance works and what upstage and downstage is and how blocking works and whatnot. So again, the jack of all trades thing, I could have been much better at any one of the things that I do if I'd focused only on that one thing. But I think at the same time, it's really been valuable to have that variety to be able to communicate. And, you know, I don't read sheet music incredibly, but it's great that I can read it well enough to figure out where edits are on a score or talk with somebody like you about a performance or even just understand the limitations or how difficult it is to be a recording engineer. And, you know, I think something that helps me get along with the great recording engineers that we've had is that I understand what they're doing and what things they have to deal with, and I'm willing to compromise. I know, like, okay, if you can get that microphone there, it's going to sound so much better. So I can do this to allow you to get that microphone there. Whereas I think somebody who had an only video background is going to say, well, I don't want to deal with this. Like, the camera goes here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's what impressed me with all of the projects from this year. And now I understand why. But you have such a sensitivity to all of the components of what goes on. And you've been such a pleasure to work with on all of these things. And you're very understanding and patient. Let's talk specifically about this season with Vancouver Opera. So we're talking about opening with La Voix Humaine, which was at the Chance Center. the one person show with Mireille Lebel that Rachel Peake directed, and then A Mall and the Night Visitors, again at the Chan, which Sarah Pelzer directed. Then you captured The Music Shop, which Dana Fradkin directed in the Vancouver Opera Space at Martha Lou Henley Hall, which I'm sure had its own share of challenges because that's not built to be a sound space or a recording space. And then, of course, Carmen Up Close and Personal with Brenna Corner. What's it been like working on these operas with the different directors?
Well, I think, like you said, all of those Van Opera shows have been some of the most varied shows out of the 150. If you were going to ask, those would be probably four of the 10 most varied shows. And I think a big part of that is that a lot of the other shows that I've been working on have been live music performance. And obviously the Van Opera stuff is based more in a theatrical stage show realm. And so there's really just so much thought put towards the details, you know, like Amal, the giant sticker that was placed on the stage that made the texture and dirt and wood and whatnot, and the beautiful set in Amal. And I mean, the lighting on all of the shows, lighting, stage design, the costume design, all of that stuff is a very different thing to most of the shows that I've been working on. Yeah, the types of shows have been quite varied as well. I mean, I really loved The Music Shop because it was so quirky and funny and slapstick. And, you know, you look at that next to Le Voix Humain, which is just this beautiful kind of film noir in color. And it's very French and it's very angular. And the set was very sparse, but quite a neat concept. And the whole top down, the bird's eye view camera, things like that. You know, it's been really fun. We've gotten to do a lot of different things on the Van Opera shows. And then, of course, Carmen with two huge projection screens, filming that with a live orchestra, and the bizarrety of having the performers facing the orchestra with the camera operators in the middle. I don't think that's probably ever going to happen again for me. One of those things that's just only in COVID and only in this kind of environment would you create something like that. And it's been great the way that Van Opera has worked around all of those COVID issues. I mean, just watching the COVID safety people, things like when a prop hits the floor, it is now unsafe and it has to be picked up by somebody with gloves and sanitized before it can go back to the actor. In The Music Shop, every take, there's hundreds of pieces of paper that hit the floor, and they would have to pick up all those pieces of paper, put them away, and take out new pieces of paper as the reset. Stuff like that, that is just made so much more difficult. But yeah, it's really great how you guys have been able to keep creating art through this.
We've had a fantastic COVID safety officer who is a singer that I've worked with over many years, who has her PhD from UBC, Leah Field. I'll give a shout out to her as well, who, you know, took the necessary training and was in the room all the time. And yeah, it's true that it's a thing that I think, you know, nobody would think about twice. But the number of times that we even had to stop in rehearsal just because, you know, oh, it looks like that person is not 3 meters away. And
yeah,
you got to stay away. And what you mentioned about props, and nobody was allowed to handle anybody else's props, or only if you were wearing gloves. And so, I mean, that could make a whole documentary, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, and I have to say, you know, over the summer, there were so many meetings on Zoom, obviously, just talking about this season. And then once the season was selected, everybody was just like, well, let's hope we can do it. And I mean, I'm so relieved that everything was able to be accomplished. And the big thing, the holdout, was also, can we have an orchestra for the Carmen production? That was the hope and the goal, which is why it was put at the very end of the season as well, because that just meant hopefully by then, a year into this, that it might be possible. And I think if we actually the taping had been now, we might not have been allowed to, because now we've gone back on another sort of third wave, fourth wave. I'm not even sure what this is being called. But it is more of a lockdown than there was when we filmed it a few weeks ago. And and of course, it's not the full orchestra, because that would be more like 60 people. But, you know, the 17 players that did it to my ears, and I think we chatted about this a bit before, Will did such a great job miking that, that in places you would never know that it's such an intimate group because it sounds so full and rich. So yeah, these are things that I know I'm super grateful for this year. And again, getting to work with you and your expertise, and I really hope that in the future too, like even as we've been talking about, once live shows are back, that there will be an element of this, whether there's live streaming or whether, again, there are special digital projects, maybe smaller things. But yeah, I don't see this going away. It has its own advantages for sure. Any dream projects that you have yet to realize or anything you can talk about in the works coming up?
It's funny because I've been so busy this year that I really haven't been able to have that time to dream or think about what I want to do, you know, and there's been so much variety.
Yeah.
I think part of why I did so many music videos back when I was in the studio was that, you know, it was that same setting every day. And so every day I was thinking like, oh, what can I do? What can I do different? What can I do different? Whereas right now I feel like every day is so different that I'm not thinking about looking for that novelty. And I'm sure that that will come back at some point. And I don't think that it will be as busy as it is right now, a year from now. You know, this is just a bizarre anomaly. And it's been so great to be able to do this for most of the performing arts organizations in Vancouver. But yeah, I think I'll have to wait. Maybe next year I'll have some passion projects on the go. I'll do something. I did a film with Chan.com called Ridge. And that was kind of a hybrid, you know, it was a COVID project and it had some live performance elements. And it also had some incredible spoken word poetry in it from Brendan McLeod. But it was really more similar to my music video passion projects. You know, I put a lot of extra time and energy into that. And that was really fun. As things have gotten busier and busier through the season, I'm just thinking about how I'm getting through, you know, making the next deadline.
And are you booked solid for the foreseeable future, the next few months?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Because what you were describing too is the novelty of all of the projects. I think you are, I'm not going to say a lone voice, but in most people's COVID experiences where they're like, just every day feels the same. Mm-hmm. That's not been your COVID experience at all.
No, and I'm one of the only people that's gotten to sit and watch live music, you know, 5-6 days a week since July.
Yeah, for sure.
And I do really appreciate that. It's pretty amazing to go into these theaters. And in some ways, you were talking about how funny it was being in the Chan and performing on that stage to nobody in the audience. But to me, because I've done 70 something or whatever shows in there since COVID, it's going to feel weird to me to be in there with an audience and to not just have, you know, my full run of the house. Like, I'm so used to just putting a camera wherever I want. And, you know, we've done lots of stuff in there from on the stage out into the empty house, because I feel like that's just such a great look. And there's something really poetic about that, given that, you know, we're not trying to hide the fact that there's no audience.
Right.
And I think that looking back on those performances in 5 or 10 years, there would be really something interesting about that. When else do you get to do performances in these huge halls with nobody in them? There's an audience of 3 camera operators. That's it.
You're like royalty.
Yeah, exactly.
You remind me of the Mad King of Bavaria. King Ludwig II was a personal friend and benefactor to Richard Wagner. And he bailed Wagner out so many times financially in his life and stuff. But basically, he had dibs on everything. And one of his castles, Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, he had a theater built, which was especially for him. And so he would command performances of Lohengrin for nobody in the house but himself, apparently. And he had, like, right, you know, the whole cast, orchestra, chorus brought in. And so you made me think of that story.
Yeah, I'm getting performances fit for a king, right?
Fit for a king, yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of awesome.
You look at the quality of the musicianship, these early Music Vancouver players, and yeah, in incredible venues that just sound so beautiful. And then, yeah, it's just me and a couple of other people.
That's awesome. And we owe it to you that you have preserved these. So thank you. And a shout out again to all the other organizations and to the wonderful musicians and artists that live here in our community. I think oftentimes, because I'm just looking out the window right now and it's the most gorgeous day, of course, and we've got the ocean and we've got the mountains and, you know, so much green space everywhere, that's probably the first thing that people think about in Vancouver. But I'm always telling people, you would be surprised how many great artists, even in the music world, when we were talking about contemporary music or early music or, you know, opera, this and that. And so it's great that now also that gets to be through technology and through, you know, the work that you've done. People from around the world can see that, and it's living on the internet. So those are great things.
And that is a bit of a silver lining of COVID as well, as a lot of these artists normally would have extensive touring schedules, or they're living in Europe. You know, somebody like Maria LaBelle, she, I think, normally lives in Germany. I think she's there now.
That's right, in Berlin.
In Berlin, yeah. But the fact that she was in Vancouver and borders were closed, and I think it was great that I was able to do, I did two or three performances with her. I did a thing with EMV with her, and then also, of course, Le Voix Humain. So yeah, the caliber of musicians that were kind of stuck in place for a while there was kind of a benefit as well.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule. And I know that you had told me that today was one of the days that you were committed to editing the Carmen project. And before we started recording, you shared your screen and showed us some of the things that are going on. And it looks amazing. And I'm so excited to see this. Thank you for all of that. And it's been really a pleasure working with you this season. And I so hope that we'll be able to continue this relationship next season and beyond.
Likewise. Yeah, it's really been a pleasure. Thanks, Les.
Thank you, Mike. Don't forget to subscribe to Vancouver Opera's digital season to see Carmen up close and personal at digital.vancouveropera.ca. We'd love to hear from you if you have any feedback or suggestions for upcoming guests. You can reach us via email at online@vancouveropera.ca. And don't forget to check out this episode's special features on our website at vancouveropera.ca/offstage. This has been Vancouver Opera Offstage. I'm your host, Les Dalla. As always, you can keep up to date with Vancouver Opera at vancouveropera.ca, where you can sign up for our e-newsletter or follow us on social media. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.